WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. At the age of 32, Willie Morris became the youngest editor-in-chief of the oldest magazine in America, Harper's. Under Morris's leadership, Harper's became a hot magazine. In his ambition to remake literary America, Morris brought on such writers as Norman Mailer, David Halberstam, William Styron, and Arthur Miller. Morris resigned under pressure in 1971. His new memoir about his years at Harper's is called New York Days. Morris came to New York in 1963 to become a junior editor of the magazine. He grew up in Mississippi, which is the subject of his first memoir, North Toward Home. He now lives in Jackson, Mississippi. He told me what Harper's was like when he took it over.
It's the oldest magazine in America, still is, with a noteworthy tradition. But I felt it had become somewhat arid and perhaps even a little smug. It was publishing a lot of pieces by diet faddists, by retired professors, writing quaint travel pieces, by retired diplomats, a little self-satisfied, and I didn't think it was reflecting in any important degree what was going on in America.
How old were you when you became the editor?
Well, let's see. I was 32.
That's very young to be the editor of a national magazine.
Well, I never thought of it in that way. I guess we were so busy putting out a magazine that we considered important. I always told people when they asked me how did it feel to be so young to be running the oldest magazine in the country, I said, well, by the age of 32, most of the baseball players have already hung up the spikes. It was then and still is a young person's profession, I think, as it should be.
When you took over Harper's, the magazine was about $125,000 to $150,000 in debt annually.
Yeah.
What did that mean to you as an editor? Did you see it as your job to turn that around and get the magazine in the red? Or did you consider the financial straits of the magazine secondary to its literary quality?
We had a mandate from the owners to really pull out all the stops over about a five-year period, not to worry too much about that deficit, but to bring in the best writers and the journalists and the poets, but with a hardcore of journalism to delve into these pressing issues and to be given the freedom and the space to do so, to revitalize an old enduring institution and let the chips fall where they may.
So you weren't worried about the money, you just wanted to put out something that you thought was good.
Well, our theory was that, you know, if it began to work and with the cooperation of owners that a deficit could be overcome, although it became a particularly difficult period in magazine publishing. A federal policy on postal rates, increased specialization of other magazines, such as those addressed to doctors who drove Mercedes and liked to ski in Aspen.
Right.
We thought that a boldness and vivid and sturdy writing would carry the day.
Well, did it? I mean, it's not always true that good quality makes for the best sales. I mean, did you feel that by boosting the quality of the magazine, you boosted the circulation? And
well, we went through a Nixon recession, and the magazine had a deficit, and we were really working, went through a lot of transformation. And I finally resigned, along with the rest of the staff, including Halberstam, Dave Halberstam, Larry L. King, and Midge Dector, Prady, and John Corey, and others, when the owners in Minneapolis decided they wanted a more specialized magazine and to use readership polls to determine what readers wanted, which we couldn't go on with that. Another alternative was to cut back drastically on circulation.
What would that have accomplished?
That would have accomplished cutting down costs, you know, mailing costs and printing costs and all the rest.
How do you cut down circulation? Tell people not to subscribe anymore?
Well, you can control the flow by size of solicitations and mailings. Also, another alternative was to go ahead and cut the staff in half, and we were putting out a magazine with a very, very small editorial staff. Really, there were only about three of us. Our staff writers were not getting paid the national norm. We'd hired David Howersam, one of the heroes in American journalism, from the New York Times, that had a salary of about $4,000 or $5,000 more than a copy boy was making in the newsroom of the Times. But the point is that when it became quite clear to me that these were the extreme alternatives, I didn't want to have anything to do with it. I mean, someone else could come in and do that magazine, but that person was not I.
So you wrote a letter of resignation. Did you think they were going to accept it?
Well, I kind of figured they were, but there was an off chance that it would jog them a little bit, and it didn't. And the staff walked out. Almost the whole staff walked out, and the owners tried other editors and other approaches. That didn't work until eventually the Coles's sold out to a rather highly conservative private foundation in 1980.
When you were forced out of the magazine, what did it feel like after being so emotionally involved with the magazine, having so much of your identity built upon being the editor of it, and suddenly it's not yours anymore?
It was made me feel very bereft. In my concluding chapters of New York Days, I tried to describe that sense of loss. Moved out to Eastern Long Island, and I missed, quite frankly, a lot of the perquisites of position, the secretaries and the power and the glamour, the business lunches, and all of a sudden to have that gone. It was a kind of a bleak time in my life. And I was only about, 37 years old, 38 or however much. And remember Bill Moyers reminded me, said, well, you still own a typewriter. And my son, David Ray, whom I was very close to, said, well, let's go to a ball game. It was not the end of life. And continuing bitterness is very, self-destructive, especially for a writer. And I realized in my heart that I was a writer, and that I was going to dedicate the rest of my life to writing, which I have done. And my whole experience as an editor, I think, has helped me immeasurably as a writer. So the bitterness did not last terribly long, but there was a profound sense of loss, and the phone stopped ringing. And
well, let me say something about
quiet,
the phone.
And it was so quiet.
I mean, you write in your book, at the beginning, you write that there were 8 million telephone numbers in Manhattan, and while you were the editor of Harper's, every one of them would have returned your calls.
Yeah.
But I'm sure it wasn't that way after you ceased being the editor of Harper's. I mean, did...
That's right.
Was that a real blow to your ego?
Well, I didn't get 8 million calls. It wasn't so much a blow to one's ego as it was such a turn of events that from clamor and... intense vivacity and activity, all of a sudden you were in the snows of Eastern Long Island in the winter, in deep silences, and you just had to proceed from there. I sat down and wrote a children's book. First thing I wrote when I got out there.
Do you feel that when you moved south again, when you returned to the south, that there were parts of your personality that came back out that you might have suppressed when you were in New York?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I don't think I could have written New York Days. if I had not returned home and become deeply rooted again in my native soil.
Why not?
It had something to do with the passing of time, really, and of engaging one's own sensibility and memory. The most valuable ally of the writer is memory itself, memory about all any of us has anyway. And someone remarked the other day, and I thought interesting, that my my Northward Home was in many ways a book about the South as seen from the perspective of the North. And now, 25 years later, the sequel to Northward Home, New York Days, is in many ways a book about the North from the perspective of the South. I had to let those 25 years pass before I could do this. A lot of people have been trying to get me to write this book for some time, but I'm glad I waited. Let things percolate in the psyche a little bit more.
Well, why did you have to wait that long? Was part of it to let all the anger pass?
Oh, it wasn't anger. I wasn't angry. Mm-hmm. It was, comprehension. Mm-hmm. Comprehension of one's own memory, really, mm-hmm. Which I think is universal to all of us, not just to writers. I deliberately tried to write a work of literature and to make some kind of sense in a historical and literary and deeply personal way of important and inflammatory and quintessential years in a young person's life that happened to have involved a great magazine, but in a period in America where everything seemed to be falling apart, although also a lot of things seemed to be coming together. New York Days is an act of memory and of coming to terms with one's memory.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I enjoy this very much.
Willie Morris's new memoir is called New York Days. We'll talk with poet James Merrill after this break. This is Fresh Air. Many of us have wanted to go far away, be utterly transformed by the experience, and return home a different person. Poet James Merrill acted on that impulse when he was 24 in the year 1950. That 2.5-year trip abroad is the subject of his new memoir, A Different Person. Merrill's father was the Merrill of the brokerage firm Merrill Lynch. James Merrill never joined the firm. Instead, he became one of America's most esteemed poets. He's won the Pulitzer Prize, 2 National Book Awards, and an award from the Library of Congress. This is the opening of his new memoir, A Different Person.
Meaning to stay as long as possible, I sailed for Europe. It was March 1950. New York and most of the people I knew had begun to close in. Or to put it differently, I felt that I alone in this or that circle of friends could see no way into the next phase. Indeed, few of my friends would have noticed if the next phase had never begun. They would have gone on meeting for gossipy lunches or drinking together at the San Remo on MacDougall Street, protected from encounters they perhaps desired with other customers by the glittering moat, inches deep, of their elusive chatter. I loved this unliterary company. It allowed me to feel more serious than I was. Other friends, by getting jobs or entering graduate schools, left me feeling distinctly less so. On the bright side, I had taught for a year at Bard College, 2 hours by car from MacDougall Street. My first book of poems had been accepted by the first publisher I sent it to, and I had recently met the love of my life, or so I thought, who promised to join me in Europe in the early summer, by which time we should both have disentangled ourselves from our past and present worlds. Was I ever coming back? Yes, yes, one of these days. But of course I would be a different person then.
I certainly understand the urge to go away and come back a different person. Can you explain your urge to do that?
Well, I felt hemmed in by the expectations that I had encouraged my friends and family to have for me, and it seemed to me that being on my own, not knowing anybody who had preconceived notions of who I was would give me a chance to be something more, spontaneous, more like the person I hoped to become, more mature.
Let's talk about the person who you were. One of the things that I think defined you to yourself and to other people was that you were born into wealth. Your father was co-founder of Merrill Lynch, the brokerage firm.
Yeah.
And your father created an unbreakable trust in each of his children's names when you turned five. So, you were born into money.
Yes.
What did you like and not like? What were the advantages and disadvantages of growing up with the family name of Merrill?
Well, the advantages, I guess, dawned on me a good deal later, you know, that I did indeed have license to please myself and to follow my own bent. I think my father was disappointed, both in my case and in my half-brothers, that we showed so little interest in entering the firm, working with him. But my half-sister's husband was the ideal younger partner, and he spent many years happy for himself and happy for my father, working for Merrill Lynch before he branched out to something else.
So what was it like for you to go abroad when you were in your 20s to places where the name of Merrill wouldn't mean what it did in America?
Oh, that was a great relief. And I think always the joy of being abroad is that nobody knows who you are. It's not just the name, but anywhere, anytime in this country that I would meet somebody, they would be able to tell just from the way I spoke the kind of semi-Ivy League upper-class education I'd had. Whereas if I were, say, in Italy, speaking Italian or even speaking English, they wouldn't necessarily leap to that conclusion. This is something only a compatriot can notice and draw conclusions from.
Writer James Merrill is my guest. His new memoir is called A Different Person. Part of the person, you know, you write that you wanted to go away to Europe and come home a different person. Part of the person who you were was defined by the fact that you were homosexual at a time when you didn't say that publicly to many people. Was that anything that you wanted to change by going away? Was that one of the things you wanted to come home and be different?
And be more at home with.
Be more at home with.
Yes.
As opposed to coming home straight instead of...
Oh, it never occurred to me that I'd come home straight, no. Mm-hmm. But it it allowed me to do as I wished without a sense of disapproving friends and family breathing down my neck.
Was there a sense of what it would mean for the family name if people found out?
Well, there was a sense among members of the family, perhaps, notably my mother, but I didn't see it that way. I mean, people back then were mainly frightened that you would become a security risk and that you would become unemployable if you were gay. Well, I was not going to work for the government, and I was not going to have that kind of job, a corporation job even. And it struck me very gradually that if you don't make any secrets of your life, you're not going to be blackmailed. What would be the point? You know, a perfect openness, a perfect lack of secrecy allows you to hold up your head, I think.
Well, you couldn't really practice, though, having a lack of secrecy. Your mother said it would kill your father if he found out you were gay. So did you ever speak to him about that?
I never spoke to him about it, but I heard that he had, in fact, found out long before. But he was a man of the world enough to take it in his stride.
Mm-hmm.
He consulted a couple of doctors, said, "Is there anything I can do about this situation?" The doctor said, "No, there isn't." And he took their advice. So I'm full of gratitude for his forbearance, for his, you know, he continued to love me, but it was never an issue.
Because you were born into money, did anybody ever not take you as seriously as you'd like? You know, some people might assume, well, it's easy for him to write. After all, he's never had to hold a job.
Yes, that's a very common idea. I have a delightful nephew, my brother's oldest son, Bruce, who said he was talking to somebody and who said, "I didn't get your name." And Bruce said, my name is Bruce Merrill. "Oh," said the friend, "any relation to the poet instead of any relation to the stockbroker?" And Bruce said, this impressed me very much, "Uncle James, you have won the Oedipal battle."
But did people take you less seriously for a while? You were born with a silver spoon in your mouth, so you had it easy.
Well, it was a view I shared. You know, how can I amount to anything if I haven't had to struggle more? So I arranged probably to struggle in exactly the arena of sexuality and looking for happiness in love. These, to me, were the contests, the agons that in my father's case would have been success in business.
Poet James Merrill, his new memoir is called A Different Person. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.